B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, March 9th, 2018. After months of trading insults, threats, and escalating tensions, Trump surprises us by quickly agreeing to accept an invitation to meet with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. And he didn't even consult with his Secretary of State. Rexxon Tillerson was over in Africa mending fences in the countries that Trump had referred to as shitholes. So this is clearly a surprise. It moved much faster than anyone, including I, could have anticipated. And while I am excited by the prospect of avoiding military action and other conflicts and pursuing diplomacy, it gives a guy like me great pause to imagine that big egos like Kim and Don can sit down and actually achieve something beyond bragging about how big their nuclear buttons are. But this is what we've been dealt, and it's going to be interesting. And I caught up with Peter Van Buren today. He's a veteran, 24 years in the U.S. State Department. Four of those years he spent in South Korea during the final years of the Clinton administration. So he knows quite a bit, and he shared quite a lot in our wide-ranging conversation that lasted about an hour today. I'm releasing it to my subscribers, but here's an excerpt where Peter Van Buren generally agrees with my assessment that Kim Jong-un is a crafty and skilled negotiator. Yes. Now, I consider this to be very crafty, skilled statesmanship on the part of little Kim. And I raise the question, is he more stable and more skillful than his American counterpart?
Well, we're going to make a diplomat out of you yet, Peter, because that's exactly what I would say is the correct reading of this. This is very skillful diplomacy on his part because he knows that he's going to have to make what the United States would consider concessions, but he doesn't want to appear to be making concessions, and he certainly doesn't want to appear to be making them under pressure from Trump. And so you hand those things over in the beginning as if they were gifts. And then you basically get to where you want to be without appearing to have given anything up. This is very skillful ways this game is played. There are other things that have signaled how serious North Korea is about this compared to previous efforts. And a couple of them go into some of the way that Korean people interact with each other and interact with the world. You take a look at the Olympics. The North Koreans sent two very important people to the Olympics. They sent Kim Jong-un's sister, and they sent Kim Jong-nam, who is a 90-year-old man who is in the background of almost every picture you see of any of the leadership there. By sending Kim's sister and offering her personal invitation that leaders from the South visit the North, they essentially made an offer that the South couldn't refuse culturally. By making that personal extension there, it trapped the South into having to accept at some level the invitation. It would have been a personal insult that would have been a hole that diplomats would have been digging out of forever. It was very skillful. The other guy, Kim Jong-nam, is 90 years old. He was a member of the Communist Party when the Japanese still occupied the peninsula. He has served all three Kims. He fought he's a combat veteran of the Korean War. His credibility with the North Korean hardliners is impeccable. And don't fool yourself. Kim Jong-un is a dictator, but he doesn't rule without consultation. He doesn't rule without at least the quiet acquiescence of his military and his intelligence people. He needs to make sure everybody is on board as he moves forward. And by sending that guy to the Olympics, he was making a very public statement, both internally to his own country and externally to the world, the people who know about these things, that what he is doing here has been vetted. It has been run through the approval process, such as it is in North Korea.
I invite you to listen to the full conversation with Peter Van Buren. We talk for about half an hour about the North Korea situation, and then we shift to his commentary about the Russiagate narrative. I think you'll find it fascinating. And let me put in my plug for the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions early in the show today, because I've been working on my taxes, and when I tabulate it, how much came in from subscribers last year, I have to say I was a little bit shocked. And I am confessing to you that because of my outspoken opinions, some of my skepticism, of course, about Trump-Russia, that many people have decided to discontinue their subscriptions here. And that means I need a whole new wave of supporters. And so I'm reaching out to you, asking you that if you listen on a regular basis and you value what you hear here, come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on menu, pull it down, click on become a subscriber. You get to the sign-up page, and there's an array of options right there. And if you're allergic to PayPal, hey, you can communicate with me directly at my P.O. Box. That's Box 150-660, San Rafael, California, zip code 94915. That's Box 150-660, and it's San Rafael, California, 94915. Now, there's quite a bit of commentary already about Trump's decision. Peter Baker, who is the thought guy, the analytical fellow who covers the White House for the New York Times, said that, this reflects an audacious and supremely self-confident approach to international affairs. Our stable genius takes on their dear leader. Our dear tweeter takes on Kim Jong-un. But Baker goes on, in his penchant for unpredictability, his willingness to shift at a moment's notice, and his sense that only he can make the important decisions, Trump may find a kindred spirit in the man who would sit across the table, Kim Jong-un. Wendy Sherman, longtime former diplomat who worked with the Clinton administration on the delegation that went to Pyongyang back in 99 or 2000, she said, in some ways there's a symmetry. You have two leaders who believe fundamentally that they are the only people who matter. Sherman went on to say this is very serious business, it's not a reality show, and it's our national security that's at stake. And I think those are all thoughtful comments. Meanwhile, Max Fisher, also at the Times, has a list of seven things that he thinks we should all understand, and I think they're rational, reasonable comments. He said that short-term, this will reduce the risk of war. That's correct. He notes that mismatched signals may have set up the talks to fail. And this is some interesting commentary. He says Trump has already committed to granting North Korea one of its most desired concessions, a high-level meeting between the heads of state. And you're probably aware that typically this is the final stage of any kind of a long-term diplomatic negotiation. And just like Trump jumped to the finale by announcing that the U.S. will move its embassy to Jerusalem, a long-sought request from Israel, he didn't get anything for it. There were no preliminaries, no underlying agreements, and that is similar to what has happened here with North Korea. Fisher goes on, in exchange, North Korea has not publicly committed to anything. It has quite cannily channeled its public communications through South Korea, making it easier to renege. Now, that's an interesting point because in my conversation with Peter Van Buren, we talk about how craftily Kim Jong-un removed issues from the dispute that were demanded as preconditions by the U.S., and by saying that he's going to voluntarily suspend nuclear and missile tests and that the U.S. and South Korea can have their war games without any protest from him, Van Buren points out that he took these things that had been seen as preconditions and instead of treating them as concessions, he offers them as kind of a gift. So back to Max Fisher here. The table is now set in such a way that virtually any outcome is a win for North Korea, but only a very narrow and difficult range of outcomes will save the United States from an embarrassing failure. He says this is a formulation that puts the Americans at significant disadvantage before talks even begin. Another issue is, of course, terminology and translation. And Trump seized on the term denuclearization that was offered by the South Koreans as a quote from Kim Jong-un. And the Times quotes a Seoul-based analyst who writes a column for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, Doo-Yun Kim. Americans understand the word denuclearization as describing North Korea's full nuclear disarmament, which, of course, is difficult to imagine. But North Koreans tend to mean that this is a kind of mutual and incremental disarmament in which the United States also gives up weapons. Now, it's going to be a short conversation if that's what Kim starts out with Trump. Item number four, the Trump administration has gotten the process backwards. I mentioned that earlier. The State Department is in shambles. They don't have an ambassador to South Korea or an undersecretary of state for arms control and international security. Too much relies on the president's personality. Amen there. And North Korea has already achieved a symbolic victory. And over at Vice News, they take a look at some of the comments that have surfaced. Rex Tillerson, traveling in Africa, said that he was not consulted. And we don't know of anyone else outside the White House who conferred with Trump before he quickly accepted the offer relayed by the South Koreans. There's been positive comment from China, Russia, Japan, and South Korea's Moon Jae-in, called the meeting a miraculous opportunity. On the negative side, we have Jeffrey Lewis, an arms control expert. He says, teeing up this, it's good if we're willing to talk, but our expectations are unrealistic in his opinion. Kim ain't giving up the bomb. So what happens when these expectations meet reality? Do we settle for less, or do we blow it up because we didn't get a pony? And Lewis also notes that there is a well-known North Korean propaganda film from 1988 called The Country I Saw. And in it, an American president visits Pyongyang, compelled by North Korea's nuclear and missile programs, to treat North Korea as an equal. And that's one of the other issues that I chewed on with Peter Van Buren. I am uncomfortable that the U.S. is elevating North Korea and Kim Jong-un to the level of a world leader just because they claim to have nuclear weapons. And Van Buren basically says I'm wrong about that and that we just have to get over it and get used to it. And get this, Lindsey Graham added a personal warning to Kim Jong-un, which I think reveals his worries about a meeting with Trump. He said, the worst possible thing you can do is meet with President Trump in person and try to play him. If you do that, it will be the end of you and your regime. Well, Lindsey, I think Trump has already been played, and we're going to see this play out further. Peter Van Buren also wrote a column that appeared at the American Conservative this week called The New Surveillance State and the Old Perjury Trap. And he makes the case that the Mueller investigation is largely based on surveillance, including what is called the incidental collection. When you claim that you're targeting an individual, but you pick up the phone call they have with someone else, and that someone else could be a Carter Page, a Steve Bannon, a Paul Manafort, a Jeff Sessions. He notes that, and we also in our interview have a good exchange about the FISA court and the way both parties ignore its obvious defects and play up the benefits that they see on a partisan basis. But he also notes that the recent leak about Jared Kushner, where we learned that there are four countries that believe they can exploit him because he's desperate to get a loan for the family business, you know, billions of dollars. Van Buren said, look, a highly classified leak was used to help marginalize Kushner. If the story is true, the leakers passed on data revealing sources and methods because the foreign officials now know that however they communicated their thoughts about Kushner, the NSA was listening. So there is a very serious problem that the widespread leaking, the anonymous sources that fuel all of these corporate media articles, that there will be a long-term negative effect as we see the leakers are able to manipulate our elected leaders. Interesting piece at The Intercept today about how the Amazon Echo is being partnered with law enforcement in England in ways that give the creeps to privacy advocates like me. Now, I have an Amazon Echo, the Alexa box, in my kitchen. And I only use it occasionally. I ask what the weather's going to be or things like that. And these things are very common now. Google's got one. And in Lancashire County in the United Kingdom, they're going to use the Amazon servers to store citizens' crime reports rather than have those saved by the police. So this becomes outsourcing. Amazon doesn't have a stated policy about how long it keeps any recordings it makes of its users' use of Alexa. But we need a clear policy from Amazon where they say we don't collect this, we don't record it, and they need to extend their position. Now, last year they did refuse to provide information from Amazon servers to police who were investigating an Alexa user for a murder in Arkansas. But we don't know what Amazon does. I don't know what Comcast does with the talking remote when I tell it to load Homeland. Does it then report that, Peter B's watching Homeland, boning up on the intersection of entertainment and surveillance? There's a very weak story in today's New York Times entitled How Russian Trolls Crept Into the Trump Campaign's Facebook Messages. And it extends on the Mueller indictment of the St. Petersburg troll farm, where we're told there were 80 employees. In this article, they reveal a persona named Matt Skibber, who was a concocted persona run by the operators of the St. Petersburg Internet Research Agency. And Skibber interacted on Facebook with low-level members of the Trump campaign in Florida, trying to get them to support plans for a huge rally of flash mobs across the state of Florida. And the Times writes here, Mr. Skibber was not an American supporter of Trump. Instead, he was a persona created by the Internet Research Agency, the Russian company indicted last month. The special counsel, Mueller, alleged that the company linked to President Putin of Russia and his country's intelligence services executed an elaborate and expensive plot to sow discord in American politics and ultimately boost Trump and damage Clinton during the 2016 presidential campaign. Now that's quite a mouthful. That paragraph is loaded with unproven assertions that are treated as fact. It was not a very expensive operation, and we don't know that it was really linked to the Russian government. That is a series of assumptions that are made by Western observers. And the idea that this was part of Russian intelligence, I think, is pretty far-fetched. I think it was more likely a commercial clickbait operation where they did enjoy sowing discord in the United States, but they were really just amplifying discord that already existed here. And I really find this kind of reporting to be a blight on what we used to call journalism in this country. A tip of my hat to Merle in Michigan. Merle lives in Royal Oak outside Detroit, and he frequently sends me links to news items. This is one I hadn't seen from AOL News, reporting that Senator Dean Heller, Republican of Nevada, was speaking at a recent event in Las Vegas, and he told the people who were assembled there, it was probably a fundraiser, that Justice Anthony Kennedy is going to retire sometime around early summer. Now, this may or may not be true, but it does send a wave of concern because Trump is most likely to go to the Federalist Society and find another clone of Neil Gorsuch. And with the Republicans still in control of the Senate, they're losing one vote with Thad Cochran, who is going to resign April 1st for health reasons. But if there is a Supreme Court confirmation process this summer, it will pack the court with conservatives and make it even more difficult to block what Trump is doing or ultimately try to remove him from office. There's a meeting of the Democratic National Committee this weekend, and they are going to make a decision about the recommendations from the Unity Reform Commission. And they are considering cutting back the number of superdelegates, which make up about 30% of those who voted at the 2016 convention. And at least some members of the committee are suggesting that they eliminate the superdelegates altogether. Now, that would be my wish. That would be my dream. But I don't expect the Democratic establishment to honor my wish or my dream. And just to throw some cold water on it, one of the sleaziest operatives in the Democratic Party is California's Bob Mulholland, and he circulated a misleading memo last night, actually Wednesday night. I understand one proposal before the Rules Committee is to deny uncommitted delegates the right to vote in our presidential nominations at our national conventions on the first vote. In other words, Presidents Obama, Clinton, and Carter would be told they cannot vote for our next president. Now, I really wouldn't mind making them, you know, former presidents, superdelegates. That would be plenty. And I don't want to deny them the right to vote for the next nominee. But what is important is that in 2016, the superdelegates, all of the elected officials of the party at the state and federal level, they all closed ranks and jammed Hillary Clinton on us, despite the obvious self-inflicted wounds, her lack of opportunity to grow her base of support, and based on their arrogant belief that Donald Trump could never possibly be elevated to the presidency. There's some really disgusting events happening related to immigration across the country. Maybe you've seen the video that's circulating online of a woman here in California who was walking down the street with her daughters. They grabbed mom, they pried her from the arms of her daughters, and muscled her into a Border Patrol vehicle. It's happening in broad daylight. And in Arizona the other day, they picked up Alejandra Pablos, a field coordinator for the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. She's been very courageous. She was in the D.C. area a couple of months ago where she participated. This was in January, in a protest in Virginia outside the Department of Homeland Security. And at that rally, she was abruptly detained by local agents. And it appears, according to Kevin Gostola at Shadowproof, that after the protest in Virginia, an ICE agent called her deportation officer in Tucson, Arizona, and sought to get her detained in retaliation for her protest. And she has a prior drug-related arrest, despite the fact that she is a legal permanent resident, and she has sought asylum against being returned to Mexico, where she fears she might be caught up in drug violence. Trump used a lot of as usual, lies or misstatements as he attacked Oakland's Mayor Libby Schaaf because she gave a warning on February 24th that there was an ICE raid imminent. And the president, Attorney General Sessions, who came to Sacramento, California the other day to spread lies and threaten Californians, they exaggerate this so much. So Trump called Mayor Schaaf a disgrace. He said that, and this isn't true, that she had warned undocumented immigrants to scatter and get out of here. Trump said that ICE had been prepared to arrest close to 1,000 people, but ICE failed to make 800 arrests that they would have made if the mayor had not acted. But that's not true, because the local top ICE dog said that after the raids, 864 criminal aliens and public safety threats remain at large in the community. But he didn't say that they were all targeted for this one specific race raid in February. And so the San Francisco Chronicle quotes the former ICE administrator under Obama for this region, And he says, well, 800 people got away. That's probably misleading. Trump also said the agency, he quoted the agency as saying that roughly 85% of those sought by federal officers had criminal records. But of the 232 people arrested on or after February 24th, only less than half of them had past criminal convictions, 115 out of 232. So you can see that they are lying routinely to justify these gross and immoral actions. Trump said he was going to drain the swamp, right? No lobbyists in his administration? Well, there are 24 of them who've received ethics waivers. And in addition, there is a very curious waiver that has been issued to the new FBI director, Christopher Wray. His waiver allows him to participate in matters involving a confidential former client. But we don't know who that is. And it's really hard to justify a waiver on that basis. He should recuse himself. Got time for a few headlines. The stack has piled up this week of stories I haven't had time to get to. In today's New York Times, John McCain and Angelina Jolie co-author an op-ed that I agree with. The U.S. must save the Rohingya. 680,000 Rohingya Muslims have been forced into exile. There's been systematic killing, arson, and rape. And we need to stand up to the government of Myanmar. And we need to call out Aung San Suu Kyi. She was given the Nobel Peace Prize, and she appeared to deserve it for helping reform Myanmar. But she is presiding over a genocide, and we should not let it stand. It's another case, though, where Trump is such a bad messenger on these issues that it's almost unfathomable to imagine that he could lead such a humanitarian effort. The general who runs AFRICOM, General Tom Waldhauser, admitted in a congressional hearing the other day that they have been filtering reports on the number of airstrikes they conduct in Libya. And basically, they've told us about only half of the 8 airstrikes that have occurred over the last 9 months or so. The Trump administration has blocked an effort that Trump encouraged. The state of Idaho is offering substandard health insurance policies at a lower rate, and the people who enforce Obamacare have to stop them. This is deeply ironic. Seema Verma is Trump's appointee at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and she told Governor C.L. Otter of Idaho that the state's plans violate the law. And if the state doesn't enforce coverage requirements, the federal government will. And then they winked and nodded and said, but hey, bring us another proposal, and we'll see if we can approve that one. I expect a question to occur in many households this weekend. Mommy, who is Stormy Daniels, and why is she on 60 Minutes with Anderson Cooper this Sunday? I think that one's going to blow up on Trump. Doesn't appear that his efforts to suppress it are working. The Vatican announced this week the path to sainthood, canonization for Pope Paul VI and for Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero, who was killed during the Iran-Contra wars engendered by the United States. And I certainly support sainthood for Romero, but now that we have a Latin American pope, can't we talk about liberation theology? That was all squelched under the Polish pope, John Paul II, who had survived the communist occupation of his country and nonetheless ordered that clerics cannot operate in the political realm. Here on the West Coast, the population of sardines has collapsed. Only 3% of the average population is left. We can turn that around. 97% have basically disappeared. Jared Kushner, the crown prince, has been scaled back in his duties, but he was dispatched by his father-in-law to visit Mexico City this week to try to mend fences with President Enrique Peña Nieto. who abruptly canceled plans to visit Trump in Washington after a testy phone call where the border wall apparently got in the way. And I'm just wondering if Jared asked Mexico for a loan for the Kushner family bankrupt properties. Everybody's going to salute this. Martin Shkreli, the farmer bro, was sentenced to 7 years in federal prison for fraud. And he's also been ordered to repay $7.36 million. That's a forfeiture. Then he has to pay $75,000 in court costs. But don't feel sorry for him. His net worth is $27 million. And finally, you know, we hear how Prince MBS, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, is relaxing these orthodox conservative rules. Women are being permitted to drive. And now there's going to be a concert performed by a pop star from Egypt named Tamer Hosni. But the rules are pretty oppressive. Dancing is strictly prohibited during the concert, as well as swaying. And you must wear modest outfits, and women will sit segregated from men. Ah, that's modern Saudi Arabia. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. It's free. You're free to share it far and wide. We post it on YouTube, and when you're there, click the subscribe thingy, will you?
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.